Welcome to Non-Native, the podcast that shares conversations between immigrants, expats, and interlopers. My name is Sarah, and in November 2014, I up sticks from Bristol in the United Kingdom to move to the west coast of the United States. Moving meant leaving behind friends, family, and the country I'd lived in my whole life for the promise of new experiences, meeting new people, and adapting to a new culture. In Non-Native, I speak with women who have moved around the world in pursuit of love, work, happiness, or adventure. Hello, and welcome back to Non-Native, the podcast that shares conversations between female immigrants, expats, and interlopers. Today's episode features an interview with Deanna, an incredibly talented musician and social activist based here in the Bay Area. Deanna is originally from Mexico and came to the United States to study as an undocumented immigrant. Her journey as a person living in the shadows, as she describes that time, and the love for her homeland are infused in the beautiful music she creates. Now with permanent resident status, Deanna is a full-time musician and an advocate for immigrant rights. It was an honor talking to her back in early June about her time living here as an undocumented person and the emotional moment she was able to set foot on Mexican soil again for the first time in 16 years. That trip was captured on film in the documentary Dear Homeland, produced by KQED, which has just been nominated for a Cine Las Americas Award and will be screened as part of their virtual showcase on July 18th. It's a beautiful film that I implore you to watch, just as I implore you to seek out Deanna's music. Details for the film and all of Deanna's projects can be found in the show notes for this episode. I'm so excited for you to listen to this one, so please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you find your podcasts to help more people find it. Hi, Deanna.
Hi, Sarah.
Thank you so much for joining me on Non-Native.
Thank you for having me.
Deanna, I've been a fan of your music since I heard you at an event a couple of years ago, and I was particularly moved by your story and your move from Mexico. So I was wondering if you could begin by telling us how you ended up here in the Bay Area.
So I moved to the Bay Area in 2008, and I moved from Michigan, from a little town called Holland, Michigan. So actually my first migration story goes back to when I was 13 years old. I first moved to the U.S. As a teenager by myself. I am originally from Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, a border town in Mexico next to El Paso, Texas, in the United States. And at 13 years old, I got in a plane by myself and came to the United States initially to visit my aunt, Sandra, who lived in Holland, Michigan. I was supposed to spend 2 months with her and her son and her husband just to spend the summer there in Holland, Michigan, and enjoy a summer by Lake Michigan. But then my aunt invited me to stay. She said, you know, she asked me if I wanted to go to school there. She saw me very, there was a moment in my visit with them where she took me to see my cousin's new middle school that he was gonna attend. And I remember going through the hallways of the school and just seeing the building and the infrastructure with so much, I was in awe. You know, it was such a beautiful school. I went to a public school in Mexico. I come from a family of 5 kids and, you know, middle-class Mexicans really just trying to make ends meet. And so I come to this, which was also a public school, but I was just so enamored by everything. And in fact, this school even had a planetarium and basketball courts and tennis courts and a track field, and it was just so beautiful. And I think the combination of that excitement and my aunt's enthusiasm to keep me by her side longer is what made her ask me if I wanted to stay and live with her for, you know, for a few months so I could learn the language. And I remember saying yes with no, I didn't even think about it. I didn't even think about like, oh, let me see what my parents think. Or, and so I remember giving her a very, you know, strong yes. And obviously yeah, I did talk to my parents, and my parents at that time were going through a divorce. And so things that back home were a little bit rough and unstable. And so, you know, and my parents had 5 kids. And so whenever this came up, my parents were okay with it. And I think also, you know, my mom has always been super supportive of anything that we kids wanted to do. And so they didn't refute the, you know, my request. And so that's how I got to the United States. You know, when I was 13 years old. And then I ended up going back to Mexico, and then going back to Michigan to pursue a career in music. And then, and so I did my career in music in Michigan as an undocumented student, because after many efforts of trying to get a student visa and become an international student, I kept getting denied. And by that point, I really wanted to stay there. And actually at that point too, I had met a boy who I fell in love with. We both fell in love. He was American, and he really supported the idea of me staying in the United States. And so so then I stayed, and I decided that I was gonna go to school, but as an undocumented student, which was not the easiest decision for me to make, as you know, being an undocumented person in the US is not easy. It's not, there are many things that we cannot do if we don't have proper documentation. But I was able to enroll in school, and so I lived in Michigan for 4 years and went through 4 years of college, and I received an associate's degree in piano performance and in recording technology. And then in 2008 is when I moved to San Francisco. I know it was kind of like a long journey to get to how I got to San Francisco, but and the way I arrived in San Francisco is I met a person, the boyfriend at the time that I had in Michigan. We broke up after 4 years, and then I met a new person, and he lived in San Francisco, and he invited me to come out and make music here and just give it a shot as a musician. Before I met him, I had already made the decision that I wanted to go back to Mexico. It was really hard to be undocumented in a place where not a lot of people were what we call out of the shadows. I didn't share my status with anybody other than my family and my boyfriend at the time. So it was very rough to feel that I couldn't share my whole self with people close to me. And so that, and then also just things started to get harder. You know, we couldn't get driver's licenses, or it was just getting harder and harder to be in a place where I felt I didn't have an identity, or where I couldn't really speak up and be myself, and feel like I had to kind of just be in the shadows. That really feels like a right description of the place that we live in emotionally when we're not allowed to do certain things because of a lack of a paper, right? And so before moving to San Francisco, I had actually decided that I was gonna move back to Mexico, which was a very hard decision, because by this point I had already spent so many years in the United States and had made so many beautiful relationships. And really, I mean, having gone to college in the United States really shaped me as a person. You know, I spent very crucial years of my life in this country. And so I was already developing so much love for this land and for its people and for the experiences I gathered here. And so it was a very hard decision, and yet I decided to go back. And then, you know, life, the universe has its mysterious ways of working. And I remember I made a trip to San Francisco with my mother. She wanted to celebrate her 50th birthday in SF, and she invited me, and I said, yes, let's do it. I'll take this as my farewell trip to the United States. This will be your 50th birthday celebration, so let's do it. And then that's where I met this new person who ended up becoming my partner, and he invited me to stay, and the rest is history. I'm still here since I've been living in the Bay Area since 2008.
That must have been an incredibly difficult decision, knowing that you wanted to continue your studies here and knowing what that would mean to live as an undocumented immigrant in terms of being able to contact and see your family back home. I'm just curious, you mentioned obviously there are many things that undocumented people can't do like easily, like apply for a driver's license. What was the process like applying for education? Were you able to assume an identity as an American citizen? How did that work? How did the school support you in that way?
No, I think, well, the thing is, the school did not require, like, they didn't do background checks or any of that. So it was easy to get into the school system. However, I had to pay tuition. Like, I couldn't have some of the things I could not do as a student. And the thing is, I don't know, maybe I could have, but you know, I didn't want to ask for financial help. I didn't want to ask for scholarships because it was kind of enough for me already to know that I had made the decision to stay as an undocumented person. And for one, I didn't know that such programs existed for undocumented students like they do in California, for example. I didn't even know of any other undocumented students, which I'm sure there were, but we were all invisible, right? For our own sake, I believe. Because how is it that in 4 years I never heard? To be honest, Sarah, I didn't even know the word undocumented existed, or that was not part of my vocabulary back then. I only knew the word illegal. And so having that in your mind or in your set of words that are used to describe you, it just makes you less prone to want to look for help or to see if there's any organization or anything that it's helping that was helping students like me. There was no representation, right? And so I didn't seek for it because, again, I wanted to be as invisible as possible. I didn't want to risk somebody or getting caught, and then that was it for my dream of finishing my career in music in this country. And so I didn't apply for any of the scholarships that were being sent my way because I think another thing that happened too, I became a really good student. Why? Well, because that's what I was here for, right? And so I had a 3.9 GPA and but I didn't dare to take them. I was just too afraid that would trigger, you know, somebody looking into my file or doing a background check. I don't know. I mean, I really did live in fear, right? In fear of getting caught, in fear of my dreams being shattered, you know? And so I thought, you know what? It's okay. This is the price I'm paying for having made the decision to stay as an undocumented person. I don't get financial aid. That's fine. I'm going to work my butt off. It's okay. I can do this. I'm young. And so I did it. I worked 50 hours a week in a fast food restaurant. And in order for me to have that many hours, I had to become a manager, you know, to be to have salary, because if I didn't do that, I would only get maybe 20 hours, 25 hours. And that was not going to be enough money to pay for my tuition, right? Because I had to pay tuition out of pocket. There were no loans. I couldn't even have a bank account as an undocumented person back then. And so no student loans, no anything, just straight out of pocket. And so I had to take that position as an assistant manager of a fast food restaurant so that I could get guaranteed 50 hours a week and a salary that would, and steady income. Ultimately, I needed steady income because I knew exactly what my costs were going to be to pay for college. And so I took that job, and it was pretty hard. I have to say there were many times where I thought, what am I doing? Like, this is actually unhealthy. You know, I was like sleeping 4 hours a night, having to commute. And so in that regard, it was really hard. Physically, it was hard. I mean, I was tired, and I was, I was exhausted. However, I do have to say, I chose a music career, right? And so I think I attribute my endurance or the fact that I was able to go through 4 years of, you know, very little sleep, working so much, being on my feet 50 hours a week, you know, whenever I worked the fast food restaurant. I attribute my endurance to the fact that I was studying music, because to me, being in school, the things I learned in school, and, you know, and I was a piano major, so I devoted 2 hours, unfortunately, not 8 hours or, you know, 10 hours as you should devote to your instrument if you want to become a pianist, a professional pianist. I couldn't do that. I could only do 2 hours a day of practice. But those 2 hours were my therapy and were my recharging sessions, I guess. You know, this is how I gain all my energy back, through music. And then Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I had choir. And now it's known. I mean, I've read articles where it is proven that singing in a choir, singing with other people, boosts your immune system. And so I had this choir practice with one of the most amazing teachers I've had in my life, Mr. Davis, Duane Davis. So not only did I have a beautiful musical experience at the end of my days on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, but also Mr. Davis made sure that we left that classroom, that choir room, empowered. And I would always leave that room feeling so much joy and even more passion about what I was studying and hopeful about the world. And so I think that was very helpful too, because as hard as it was physically on my body to have done that right through school, it's like music saved me or helped me go through that difficult time.
And how is it serving you now, your music, your status, your journey, your homeland, your adopted homeland? How does that weave itself into your music?
I almost want to say that everything I do with my music now was influenced by that journey. Was influenced by the fact that I was an undocumented person, an undocumented student, an undocumented worker, because I think the struggle that I may have gone through or some of the hardships that I had gave me enough perspective and understanding of what being an immigrant was. But I was also, within that struggle, I was also very privileged, right? I came here because I decided to come here. I was not brought here by my parents. You know, I actually made the decision to be here. and I knew what I was getting into. So I chose that for myself. And I came here, you know, in a plane, sitting comfortably in a plane. I did not cross the desert like many people do. I did not flee domestic violence or, so definitely my situation was different from the situation that many, immigrants and refugees and families that come to this country go through. And so I was always very much aware of that. And however, you know, I did get to meet some of these people, and having been an undocumented person allowed me to be open and receptive to hear these stories and to absorb them and to, if anything, feel grateful for the life I was living, accomplishing my dreams of becoming a musician. It's something that I wanted to do, not something that I wanted to do to make my parents happy or to pay them for. You know, it was like it's a very different story that you than some of these stories that you hear. And so that awareness made me realize many things that I think are all living in my music, lyrically and maybe even musically too, I think, because I think from a lyrical point of view, my songs talk about the journeys that we embark on when we leave the homeland, the nostalgia, but also the joy of being in a new land, and also the opportunity and the you know, the love for both lands, and the questions about what is home, where is home, what does that even mean, you know, to be home, to feel at home. And so it's all in my music. And I think also musically, I tend to choose rhythms that are soothing, that will maybe take me back to remembering the sounds of my homeland, and also infused with my new homeland. I mean, this is also my home. The United States is also my home, and so I have also been influenced by the sounds I've heard here. And so it's all there. It's all in the things I create, in the music, and the projects I get involved in the activism that I do. So yeah, I think that story and my journey is very much alive in my music.
That's beautiful. So you mentioned that you came to San Francisco and the Bay Area following your heart, as well as your desire to be a musician, and you were still undocumented at that time. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how has your status journey evolved since that point?
Yeah, so now, after a few years of, maybe about 4 years of arriving in San Francisco, I was able to get a work visa. And through this work visa, I would be able to apply for a green card eventually. And so I did. But everything sort of coincided with this new administration taking office. And so things got delayed. And so I actually had to wait about 4 years from the moment I had my work visa until I was able to get my green card. And so altogether, or in total, I spent 16 years without being able to travel to Mexico. So, because usually, because of my situation, and each immigration case, it's so different, as you may know. And so it was too risky for me to leave the United States, even though I had a work visa, because I would not be guaranteed that I'd be able to come back. And at this point, I didn't want to risk it. I had been waiting to have legal status for so long that I just decided to wait. You know, if I waited 10 years already, I'm sure I can wait another couple years. But then that couple years turned into more like 4 years. But it was okay, you know, I have a green card now, and in 2018 I was able to go back to Ciudad Juarez, to my hometown.
That must have been an absolutely incredible feeling, not only of relief to get the green card, which, yeah, I have some knowledge of, but obviously our situations are very different. Can you just tell us, for the listeners, what that felt like to return to Mexico for the first time in such a long time?
I mean, it was beautiful. It's almost like I still can't find the words. It's been 2 years, and when you know, as an immigrant, you know, who lives as an undocumented person, who knows I'm not going to be able to go back for a few years, I think as a coping mechanism, it's almost like you shut down certain part of your brain or of your emotions so that you can, you know, so that you can keep living and doing your day-to-day activities. And the love I have for my homeland is so immense that when I, you know, when I knew I was not going to be able to go back, I think that there was a part of me that shut down so that I could, you know, keep focusing on my music and on the things that I was doing, on the projects, you know, and also moving to San Francisco was life-changing. All of a sudden, I was just so immersed in the culture here, because I think San Francisco is just, it just seems like it's another country, to be honest. It's, you know, some people call it a bubble, and I think it is. I mean, I did not feel as free. Sorry, I felt so free coming to San Francisco in a way that I did not feel when I was living in Michigan. And just experiencing the diversity of cultures and of ideologies and of religions and of minds that were open and receiving and welcoming to me and to others like me, and open to my music, even though my music is mainly sung in Spanish. And I just felt so loved, and so that was a good thing, right? And also, I think that also helped me maybe miss my homeland less. I mean, obviously I missed it, but I think that part that I tell you that was shut down a little bit, was still shut down, right? And then this happiness, this joy to be in San Francisco also took over. And so I just couldn't bear the thought of having to live with that nostalgia. So I didn't, right? So I kind of shut it down. I mean, I would still sing about it and I would still get teary if I heard mariachi, but definitely, and sorry to keep saying that word or keep repeating myself about how I shut down, but I guess I make an emphasis on it because this is how I lived for 16 years. This is the only explanation I can give to the fact that it has taken me so long to come back and come out of this trance that I was in, where I wasn't really thinking about Mexico. So then when I go back, you know, to this place where to the place that raised me and where I made my first friends, where I learned how to speak, you know, this was my first introduction to the world. You know, I was going back to the town where I grew up, where I went to school, where I was born, Ciudad Juarez, and also to the house where I grew up, because I was fortunate to go back to the same house that I had left. Not everybody has that fortune, and I did, and so it's been a process. I mean, it's kind of it feels a little bit weird that I'd get emotional about. It's almost like, Diana, come on, you got your green card, like, you're there, like, why are you crying, you know, why are you so emotional, like, stop it, you know, like, it's, freedom is here, celebrate. And I do, I mean, trust me, I do. Mariachis were waiting for me on my return. My family gathered flowers, and a lot of people came out, because what I did is I decided that I wanted to cross the border by foot. You know, I arrived in El Paso, and I wanted to slowly, you know, sort of take it in slowly. I mean, it was 16 years of not being able to see my land, my homeland, that I wanted to do it gradually. And so I walked that international bridge. It's like a border crossing. I arrived in El Paso and crossed with my guitar and a camera too, because KQED made a film about my return, so they followed me with cameras to document that return. I'm also carrying names in my pocket of people that told me, I wish I could do that too. There were many people that wrote me, undocumented students and people that I held in my heart, and I wrote on a piece of paper and put in my pocket, of people who, you know, who are undocumented and don't have the privilege to make that journey back to the homeland. And so it was a symbol of my solidarity with them to kind of have them with me on that trip and inviting them. I have my brother's name on there too. He lives in Ohio. And yeah, so I crossed the bridge, and then I set foot on Ciudad Juarez, and everything feels different. Even the air just feels somehow warmer. The people passing by, the accents, the street vendors, the colors, the folklore, the man in a bicycle offering me pan ranchero, farmer's bread, an old man selling saint stamps, the two little indigenous girls with their beautiful smiles and their beautiful dresses. This is what I'm seeing as I'm walking that street. And then at the end of that street, I see my family and a band of mariachis, and my mother just carrying a beautiful bouquet of flowers. My dad. And this is, so this street ends on the most centric part of Juarez, or the downtown of Juarez, which is actually just a pedestrian street, which is really beautiful because there were no cars. It was just, you know, it's all street vendors, and so a lot of folklore. My family's there, the mariachis, and they start playing, and that's the moment where it's almost like I was snapped out of that trance where I wasn't sure, was this real? Is this, what is this? If you have seen the movie Coco, do you know that time when you enter, you know, as a viewer, when you're watching the movie, there's that scene where you see the world of the dead, and it's full of folklore and these alebrijes flying, and it kind of felt like that, because there was just so much stimuli and so much happening. It was hard not to feel present and to feel things. And so I did, right? I that walking that street meant I was slowly warming up to finally snapping out of it, which was the moment when the mariachi started singing. And you know, and my family hugged me, and my dad, my mother, my siblings, my nephews. And then as a mariachi starting a new song, I see my cousin, who I had not seen for 20 years. I do have to say, I did get to see my family in these 16 years. You know, they did have visas to travel to the US, and so I did get to see them. The longest I didn't get to see a member of my family was my dad. I didn't get to see him for 7 years, but everyone else I did see quite often, once a year, sometimes every 2 years. But however, this cousin of mine, who is more like a sister to me, I didn't get to see her for almost 20 years. And she's also a singer and a beautiful human being, very talented person. And she came out and started singing along to the mariachis, a very traditional song that says, "If I die away from my homeland, tell them I am asleep and bring me here. Bring me here. My dear Mexico, if I die away from you, please tell them I am asleep and bring me here." And so anyway, and my cousin started singing that song, and of course I joined. And this is something that we used to do growing up. We would sing together and harmonize. And so for her to come out and sing that song, and for me to use my own voice to sing with her, and especially singing this song that is so emblematic for Mexican people, it was just like, that was it. That was the moment where I snapped out of that surreal place.
Right. I guess you're on a journey, a 16-year long journey, a journey that started before that. And while this moment you're describing is no means the end of that journey, it certainly sounds like the end of an incredibly challenging process and such an incredibly emotional and heartfelt moment.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure to hear you talk about it. I know that was hard, but I'm honored that we get to hear about such a special experience.
Yeah, thank you for letting me share and relive that moment. I mean, it was such a it's been one of the best moments of my life, and so it's good to relive it.
It's wonderful. And you mentioned briefly that you had a documentary crew with you following you on that journey across the border. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, the project and the film?
Yeah, sure. So Claudia Escobar, an incredible filmmaker from Colombia, living in the Bay Area, through KQED, made a documentary about my journey and on how the Anagameros, how I found my voice, my musical and my political voice as an undocumented immigrant or as a former undocumented immigrant. So this documentary is going to premiere this Wednesday on June 3rd, and we're going to have a virtual premiere. We had to cancel our premiere in the theater, but I am actually thinking a lot about the meaning of us having a virtual premiere, because, you know, a lot of my message is, you know, lies in my desire of wanting to dissolve borders, and if anything, I think having a virtual premiere means that we're all going to be able to watch, you know, anywhere in the world is going to be able to watch the film with us, you know, together, all together at the same time. And so if anything, I think it's a very meaningful way to present this film for the first time.
That leads on to my next question. And I truly don't know how you can kind of sum it up in a simple answer, but for every guest that comes on Non-Native, I always ask them, you know, what does the idea of migration mean to you? And it's so personal to everybody. But what does, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what migration and the power to move means to you.
To me, migration is a human right. And it should be seen as a human right, and it should be acted upon as a human right. And I think migration should be beautiful. It's not always beautiful. In fact, it can be terrifying. In fact, it is terrifying when if we realize that as we speak, there are children without their parents in a detention center, or parents in a detention center wondering where their kids are. So migration is not always beautiful, but it should be. I think it should be as beautiful as a whale swimming through the ocean, or as a bird flying calmly and freely. It should be as beautiful as that. And I think that the brave and courageous decision of people to embark on new journeys in search of a new, better, and safe home and life should be not only supported but celebrated. Not condemned.
I couldn't agree more. You mentioned that your time as a student, as an undocumented person, kind of crossed from one administration to another. And certainly it feels like the word immigrant is incredibly charged right now and has been for the last few years. Is there anything that you wish that you could say, and perhaps you do, through your music, but is there anything that you wish you could say to people who don't believe in immigration or feel strongly that it's wrong and that there is this legal, illegal nature of how we live our lives?
Well, I think there is so much that we all need to learn, and especially people condemning other people's journeys. I think that action most likely comes from ignorance, from not knowing. For one, for not knowing history, for not knowing really how humans work in general. I'm going to try to make an analogy here. See, bear with me. I hope it works, but I don't know how back I want to go. I should go as back as if a system of oppression or a country is causing or is starting fires in other places, in other countries, well, things are going to happen. Houses are going to burn down. People will have to flee that area because they no longer have a safe place to live. They must flee. That's what humans do. And especially if you have kids. And you're going to flee out of love. Yeah, maybe you're going to be driven by fear or by survival, but you're going to do it out of love too. That's what mothers and fathers do to protect and to make sure that their kids have a better life, a good life, which all humans deserve. And so the very least thing that we can do is welcome and support people that are looking to relocate, that are looking to find a new place. And so it's important that we go as far back as why are people leaving in the first place? What happened? And I know this may be a little excessive for some people, but I strongly believe in reparations too. That may be a big word, and maybe first we should, at least I would love to see us supporting the idea of welcoming and supporting and celebrating people that are migrating. If we can get reparations, then that's going to be a day of joy, of immense joy. But if we can at least support, and for now, just get them out of detention centers, especially now during COVID times. And so we must learn the right history. We must learn history in order for us to know what is driving these people to migrate, and what have we done to, what have we contributed to those causes that have made them migrate? Because I could tell you, let's, you know, be compassionate and really listen to their stories. But really, if you, I don't even have to get to your heart. If you get to open the right history book, it's going to be all laid out for you. I don't need to convince you. I don't need to change your heart. You know, you're going to do the math. And also too, I think what we lived through this pandemic too, I think I'm hoping that it's making people reflect on the things desperate people do in order to protect their lives, the lives of their children. People were doing it, right, in the United States. When that shelter in place order came out, everybody rushed to the stores and they, everybody was sort of in like apocalyptic mode, right? But what does that mean? Well, that means that people were afraid and they were trying to protect themselves and their families, right? Well, that's exactly what some of these immigrants do. And obviously I'm talking about immigrants that have had it, you know, more rough than I guess you and me. But, you know, but if I don't speak up for that, then, and if I don't use my music as a platform to speak about those specific stories as well as my story, I might as well stop doing music. You know, really, that's been my inspiration for writing songs and for being on a stage. You know, it's what fuels me. And yeah, and I will keep doing it because it keeps being relevant. You know, I really wish that my song SB 1070 that I wrote in 2010, 10 years ago. It's a song that I wrote after the toughest anti-immigration law at that time was passed in Arizona, Senate Bill 1070. And it was in response to that. And, you know, and I remember a few years ago, I was like, oh man, I can't, you know, some of these songs, like they're so old, but they're still relevant, unfortunately. And so I just kind of have it in me to keep writing about these things and keep singing about these things. And along with celebrating the joys of what being an immigrant is, it's everything, right? It's not a black and white story. Like you said, it has many shades. And they all must be celebrated. And I think, too, this documentary, if you allow me to add, the documentary is also exploring that world of joy and of pursuing our dreams and pursuing our happiness and celebrating that joy. It's a beautiful thing to come to a new place, right? I mean, it's enlightening, it's exciting. We learn so much. We meet new people. We meet new ways of doing things. New languages, new accents, new colors, new structures, new ways of organizing. I mean, I love this country. I love the United States as well, is my own country.
Yeah, and you're so right. It isn't just about what we miss or what we leave behind. There is so much joy and learning and so many things to discover when you move to a new country and a new environment.
Deanna, I'd love for people to listen to your music and watch Dear Homeland. Where can people find you on the internet to learn more about your story and your music?
Yeah. Oh, and I keep forgetting, but I'd also like to mention there's also a song that will be coming out really soon. I believe June 5th. We may postpone the release, but it's a song that a group of Bay Area artists and activists and music enablers and cultural workers worked on, and it's called Our Children Are Sacred, and it's a song that sheds light on the journeys of these children and their families migrating from Central America and coming to the U.S. and speaks up about their right to be free and move freely and be out of cages. And so that's coming out pretty soon. So you will be able to find that song and information about my projects, my music, my concerts on my website, dianagameros.com. And that's how you can find me on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook with my name, Diana Gameros.
Wonderful. And we'll put links to all of those sites and handles in the description box for this show.
Awesome. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Diana. Thanks for listening to Non-Native. If you like what you heard, subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at ShipshapeBF or over on my blog, shipshapeinbristolfashion.com.